This is Audible.
Crossroad Press presents Cabal, written by Clive Barker, narrated by Chet Williamson.
Part 1. Loco. I was born alive. Isn't that punishment enough? Mary Hendrickson, at her trial for patricide. Chapter 1. The Truth. Of all the rash and midnight promises made in the name of love, none, Boone now knew, was more certain to be broken than, "I'll never leave you." What time didn't steal from under your nose? Circumstance did. It was useless to hope otherwise, useless to dream that the world somehow meant you good. Everything of value, everything you clung to for your sanity, would rot or be snatched in the long run, and the abyss would gape beneath you, as it gaped for Boone now. And suddenly, without so much as a breath of explanation, you were gone. Gone to hell or worse, professions of love and all. His outlook hadn't always been so pessimistic. There'd been a time, not all that long ago, when he'd felt the burden of his mental anguish lifting. There'd been fewer psychotic episodes, fewer days when he felt like slitting his wrists rather than enduring the hours till his next medication. There'd seemed to be a chance for happiness. It was that prospect that had won the declaration of love from him, that "I'll never leave you," whispered in Lori's ear as they lay in the narrow bed he'd never dared hope would hold too. The words had not come in the throes of high passion. Their love life, like so much else between them, was fraught with problems. But where other women had given up on him, unforgiving of his failure, she'd persevered, told him there was plenty of time to get it right, all the time in the world. "I'm with you for as long as you want me to be," her patience had seemed to say. Nobody had ever offered such a commitment, and he wanted to offer one in return. Those words, "I'll never leave you," were it. The memory of them, and of her skin almost luminous in the murk of his room, and of the sound of her breathing when she finally fell asleep beside him, all of it still had the power to catch his heart and squeeze it till it hurt. He longed to be free of both the memory and the words, now that circumstance had taken away any hope of their fulfillment. But they wouldn't be forgotten. They lingered on to torment him with his frailty. His meager comfort was that she, knowing what she must now know about him, would be working to erase her memory, and that with time she'd succeed. He only hoped she'd understand his ignorance of himself when he'd voiced that promise. He'd never have risked this pain if he'd doubted health was finally within his grasp. Dream on. Decker had brought an abrupt end to those delusions, the day he'd locked the office door, drawn the blinds on the Alberta spring sunshine, and said, in a voice barely louder than a whisper, "Boone, I think we're in terrible trouble, you and I." He was trembling, Boone saw, a fact not easily concealed in a body so big. Decker had the physique of a man who sweated out the day's angst in a gym. Even his tailored suits, always charcoal, couldn't tame his bulk. It had made Boone edgy at the start of their work together. He'd felt intimidated by the doctor's physical and mental authority. Now it was the fallibility of that strength he feared. Decker was a rock. He was reason. He was calm. This anxiety ran counter to all he knew about the man. "What's wrong?" Boone asked. "Sit, will you? Sit, and I'll tell you." Boone did as he was told. In this office, Decker was lord. The doctor leaned back in the leather chair and inhaled through his nose, his mouth sealed in a downward curve. "Tell me," Boone said. "Where to start?" "Anywhere." "I thought you were getting better," Decker said. I really did. We both did. I still am, Boone said. Decker made a small shake of his head. He was a man of considerable intellect, but little of it showed on his tightly packed features, except perhaps in his eyes, which at the moment were not watching the patient, but were fixed on the table between them. You've started to talk in your sessions, Decker said, about crimes you've committed. Do you remember any of that? You know I don't. The trances Decker put him in were too profound. I only remember when you play the tape back. I won't be playing any of these, Decker said. I erased them. Why? Because I'm afraid, Boone, for you. He paused. Maybe for both of us. The crack in the rock was opening, and there was nothing Decker could do to conceal it. What are these crimes? Boone asked, his words tentative. Murders. You talk about them obsessively. At first I thought they were dream crimes. You always had a violent streak in you. And now? Now I'm afraid you may have actually committed them. There was a long silence while Boone studied Decker, more in puzzlement than anger. The blinds had not been pulled all the way down. A slice of sunlight fell across him and onto the table between them. On the glass surface was a bottle of still water, two tumblers, and a large envelope. Decker leaned forward and picked it up. What I'm doing now is probably a crime in itself, he told Boone. Patient confidentiality is one thing. Protecting a killer is another. But part of me is still hoping to God it isn't true. I want to believe I've succeeded. We've succeeded, together. I want to believe you're well. I am well. In lieu of reply, Decker tore open the envelope. I'd like you to look at these for me, he said, sliding his hand inside and bringing out a sheaf of photographs to meet the light. I warn you, they're not pleasant. He laid them on his reflection, turned for Boone's perusal. His warning had been well advised. The picture on the top of the pile was like a physical assault. Faced with it, a fear rose in him he'd not felt since being in Decker's care, that the image might possess him. He'd built walls against that superstition, brick by brick, but they shook now and threatened to fall. It's just a picture. That's right, Decker replied. It's just a picture. What do you see? A dead man. A murdered man. Yes, a murdered man. Not simply murdered, butchered. The life slashed from him in a fury of slices and stabs, his blood flung on the blade that had taken out his neck, taken off his face, onto the wall behind him. He wore only his shorts, so the wounds on his body could be easily counted, despite the blood. Boone did just that now, to keep the horror from overcoming him. Even here, in this room where the doctor had chiseled another self from the block of his patient's condition, Boone had never choked on terror as he choked now. He tasted his breakfast in the back of his throat, or the meal the night before, rising from his bowels against nature, shit in his mouth, like the dirt of his deed. Count the wounds, he told himself. Pretend they're beads on an abacus. 3, 4, 5 in the abdomen and chest, one in particular ragged, more like a tear than a wound, gaping so wide the man's innards poked out. On the shoulder, 2 more. And then the face, unmade with cuts. So many their numbers could not be calculated, even by the most detached of observers. They left the victim beyond recognition, eyes dug out, lips slit off, nose in ribbons. Enough, Decker said, as if the question needed asking. Yes, there's a lot more to see. He uncovered the second, laying the first beside the pile. This one was of a woman, sprawled on a sofa, her upper and lower body twisted in a fashion life would have forbidden. Though she was presumably not a relation of the first victim, The butcher had created a vile resemblance. Here was the same liplessness, the same eyelessness. Born from different parents, they were siblings in death, destroyed by the same hand. And am I their father? Boone found himself thinking. No, was his gut's response. I didn't do this. But two things prevented him from voicing his denial. First, he knew that Decker would not be endangering his patient's equilibrium this way unless he had good reason to do so. Second, denial was valueless when both of them knew how easily Boone's mind had deceived itself in the past. If he was responsible for these atrocities, there was no certainty he'd know it. Instead, he kept his silence, not daring to look up at Decker for fear he'd see the rock shattered. Another, Decker said, if we must, we must. He uncovered a third photograph and a fourth, laying the pictures out on the table like cards at a tarot reading, except that every one was death. In the kitchen, lying at the open door of the refrigerator. In the bedroom, beside the lamp and the alarm. At the top of the stairs, at the window. The victims were of every age and color, men, women, and children. Whatever fiend was responsible, he cared to make no distinction. He simply erased life wherever he found it, not quickly, not efficiently. The rooms in which these people had died bore plain testament to how the killer, in his humor, had toyed with them. Furniture had been overturned as they stumbled to avoid the coup de grace. Blood prints left on walls and paintwork. One had lost his fingers to the blade, snatching at it, perhaps. Most had lost their eyes. But none had escaped, however brave their resistance. They'd all fallen at last, tangled in their underwear or seeking refuge behind a curtain. Fallen sobbing, fallen retching. There were 11 photographs in all. Every one was different, but also the same. All pictures of a madness performed, taken with the actor already departed. God Almighty, was he that man? Not having an answer for himself, he asked the question of the rock, speaking without looking up from the shining cards. Did I do this? He said. He heard Decker sigh, but there was no answer forthcoming, so he chanced a glance at his accuser. As the photographs had been laid out before him, he'd felt the man's scrutiny like a crawling ache in his scalp, but now he once more found that gaze averted. "Please tell me," he said. "Did I do this?" Decker wiped the moist purses of skin beneath his gray eyes. He was not trembling any longer. "I hope not," he said. The response seemed ludicrously mild. This was not some minor infringement of the law they were debating. It was death times 11. And how many more might there be, out of sight, out of mind? "Tell me what I talked about," Boone said. "Tell me the words." "It was ramblings, mostly." "So what makes you think I'm responsible? You must have reasons." "It took time," Decker said, "for me to piece the whole thing together." He looked down at the mortuary on the table, a lining of photograph that was a little askew with his middle finger. "I have to make a quarterly report on our progress, you know that. So I play all the tapes of our previous sessions sequentially to get some sense of how we're doing." He spoke slowly, wearily. "And I noticed the same phrases coming up in your responses, buried most of the time in other material, but there. It was as if you were confessing to something, but something so abhorrent to you, even in a trance state, you couldn't quite bring yourself to say it. Instead, it was coming out in this code." Boone knew codes. He'd heard them everywhere during the bad times. Messages from the imagined enemy in the noise between stations on the radio, or in the murmur of traffic before dawn. That he might have learned the art himself came as no surprise. I made a few casual inquiries, Decker continued, among police officers I've treated. Nothing specific. And they told me about the killings. I'd heard some of the details, of course, from the press. Seems they've been going on for 2.5 years, several here in Calgary, the rest within an hour's drive. The work of one man. Me. I don't know, Decker said, finally looking up at Boone. If I was certain, I'd have reported it all, but you're not. I don't want to believe this any more than you do. It doesn't cover me in glory if this turns out to be true. There was anger in him, not well concealed. That's why I waited, hoping you'd be with me when the next one happened. You mean, some of these people died while you knew? Yes, Decker said flatly. Jesus! The thought propelled Boone from the chair, his leg catching the table. The murder scenes flew. Keep your voice down, Decker demanded. People died? And you waited? I took that risk for you, Boone. You'll respect that. Boone turned from the man. There was a chill of sweat on his spine. Sit down, said Decker. Please sit down. And tell me what these photographs mean to you. Involuntarily, Boone had put his hand over the lower half of his face. He knew from Decker's instruction what this particular piece of body language signified. His mind was using his body to muffle some disclosure, or to silence it completely. Boone, I need answers. They mean nothing, Boone said, not turning. At all? At all. Look at them again. No, Boone insisted. I can't. He heard the doctor inhale, and half expected a demand that he face the horrors afresh. But instead, Decker's tone was placatory. It's all right, Aaron, he said. It's all right. I'll put them away. Boone pressed the heels of his hands against his closed eyes. His sockets were hot and wet. They're gone, Aaron, Decker said. No, they're not. They were with him still, perfectly remembered. 11 rooms and 11 bodies fixed in his mind's eye. The wall Decker had taken 5 years to build had been brought down in as many minutes, and by its architect. Boone was at the mercy of his madness again. He heard it whine in his head, coming from 11 slit windpipes, from 11 punctured bellies, breath and bowel gas, singing the old mad songs. Why had his defenses tumbled so easily after so much labor? His eyes knew the answer, spilling tears to admit what his tongue couldn't. He was guilty. Why else? Hands he was even now wiping dry on his trousers had tortured and slaughtered. If he pretended otherwise, he'd only tempt them to further crime. Better that he confessed, though he remembered nothing, than offer them another unguarded moment. He turned and faced Decker. The photographs had been gathered up and laid face down on the table. You remember something? The doctor said, reading the change on Boone's face. Yes, he replied. What? I did it, Boone said simply. I did it all. Chapter 2 Academy 1 Decker was the most benign prosecutor any accused man could ask for. The hours he spent with Boone after that first day were filled with carefully plied questions as, murder by murder, they examined together the evidence for Boone's secret life. Despite the patient's insistence that the crimes were his, Decker counseled caution. Admissions of culpability were not hard evidence. They had to be certain that confession wasn't simply Boone's self-destructive tendencies at work, admitting to the crime out of hunger for the punishment. Boone was in no position to argue. Decker knew him better than he knew himself. Nor had he forgotten Decker's observation that if the worst was proved true, the doctor's reputation as a healer would be thrown to the dogs. They could neither of them afford to be wrong. The only way to be sure was to run through the details of the killings, dates, names, and locations, in the hope that Boone would be prompted into remembering, or else that they'd discover a killing that had occurred when he was indisputably in the company of others. The only part of the process Boone balked at was re-examining the photographs. He resisted Decker's gentle pressure for 48 hours, only conceding when Decker rounded on him, accusing him of cowardice and deceit. Was all this just a game? Decker demanded, an exercise in self-mortification that would end with them both none the wiser? If so, Boone should get the hell out of his office now and bleed on somebody else's time. Boone agreed to study the photographs. There was nothing in them that jogged his memory. Much of the detail of the rooms had been washed out by the flash of the camera. What remained was commonplace. The only sight that might have won a response from him, the faces of the victims, had been hacked beyond recognition. The most expert of morticians would not be able to piece those shattered facades together again. So it was all down to the petty details of where Boone had been on this night or that, with whom, doing what. He had never kept a diary, so verifying the facts was difficult. But most of the time, barring the hours he spent with Lori or Decker, none of which seemed to coincide with murder nights, he was alone and without alibi. By the end of the fourth day, the case against him began to look very persuasive. Enough, he told Decker. We've done enough. I'd like to go over it all one more time. What's the use? Boone said. I want to get it all finished with. In the past days and nights, many of the old symptoms, the signs of the sickness he thought he'd been so close to throwing off forever, had returned. He could sleep for no more than minutes at a time before appalling visions threw him into befuddled wakefulness. He couldn't eat properly. He was trembling from his gut outward every minute of the day. He wanted an end to this, wanted to spill the story and to be punished. Give me a little more time, Decker said. If we go to the police now, they'll take you out of my hands. They probably won't even allow me access to you. You'll be alone. I already am, Boone replied. Since he'd first seen the photographs, he'd cut himself off from every contact, even with Lori, fearing his capacity to do harm. I'm a monster, he said. We both of us know that. We've got all the evidence we need. It's not just a question of evidence. What then? Decker leaned against the window frame, his bulk a burden to him of late. I don't understand you, Boone, he said. Boone's gaze moved off from man to sky. There was a wind from the southeast today. Scraps of cloud hurried before it. A good life, Boone thought, to be up there, lighter than air. Here everything was heavy, flesh and guilt cracking your spine. I've spent 5 years trying to understand your illness, hoping I could cure it. And I thought I was succeeding, thought there was a chance it would all come clear. He fell silent in the pit of his failure. Boone was not so immersed in his own agonies he couldn't see how profoundly the man suffered. But he could do nothing to mitigate that hurt. He just watched the clouds pass, up there in the light, and knew there were only dark times ahead. When the police take you, Decker murmured, it won't just be you who's alone, Boone. I'll be alone, too. You'll be somebody else's patient, some criminal psychologist. I won't have access to you any longer. That's why I'm asking, give me a little more time. Let me understand as much as I can before it's over between us. He's talking like a lover, Boone vaguely thought, like what's between us is his life. I know you're in pain, Decker went on, so I've got medication for you, pills to keep the worst of it at bay, just till we've finished. I don't trust myself, Boone said. I could hurt somebody. You won't, Decker replied with welcome certainty. The drugs'll keep you subdued through the night. The rest of the time you'll be with me. You'll be safe with me. How much longer do you want? A few days at the most. That's not so much to ask, is it? I need to know why we failed. The thought of retreading that bloodied ground was abhorrent, but there was a debt here to be paid. With Decker's help, he'd had a glimpse of new possibilities. He owed the doctor the chance to snatch something from the ruins of that vision. "Make it quick," he said. "Thank you," Decker said. "This means a lot to me. And I'll need the pills." 2. The pills he had. Decker made sure of that. Pills so strong he wasn't sure he could have named himself correctly once he'd taken them. Pills that made sleep easy and waking a visit to a half-life he was happy to escape again. Pills that, within 24 hours, he was addicted to. Decker's word was good. When he asked for more, they were supplied, and under their soporific influence they went back to the business of the evidence. As the doctor went over and over again the details of Boone's crimes in the hope of comprehending them. But nothing came clear. All Boone's increasingly passive mind could recover from these sessions were slurred images of doors he'd slipped through and stairs he'd climbed in the performance of murder. He was less and less aware of Decker, still fighting to salvage something of worth from his patient's closed mind. All Boone knew now was sleep and guilt and the hope, increasingly cherished, of an end to both. Only Lori, or rather memories of her, penetrated the drug's regime. He could hear her voice sometimes in his inner ear, clear as a bell, repeating words she'd spoken to him in some casual conversation which he was dredging up from the past. There was nothing of consequence in these phrases. They were perhaps associated with a look he'd treasured or a touch. Now he could remember neither look nor touch. The drugs had removed so much of his capacity to imagine. All he was left with were these dislocated lines, distressing him not simply because they were spoken as if by somebody at his shoulder, but because they had no context that he could recall. And worse than either, their sound reminded him of the woman he'd loved and would not see again, unless across a courtroom. A woman to whom he had made a promise he'd broken within weeks of his making it. In his wretchedness, his thoughts barely cogent, that broken promise was as monstrous as the crimes in the photographs. It fitted him for hell. Or death. Better death. He was not entirely sure how long had passed since he'd done the deal with Decker, exchanging this stupor for a few more days of investigation, but he was certain he had kept his side of the bargain. He was talked out. There was nothing left to say or hear. All that remained was to take himself to the law and confess his crimes, or to do what the state no longer had the power to do, and kill the monster. He didn't dare alert Decker to this plan. He knew the doctor would do all in his power to prevent his patient's suicide. So he went on, playing the quiescent subject one day more. Then, promising Decker he'd be at the office the following morning, he returned home and prepared to kill himself. There was another letter from Lori awaiting him, the fourth since he'd absented himself, demanding to know what was wrong. He read it as best his befuddled thoughts would allow, and attempted a reply, but couldn't make sense of the words he was trying to write. Instead, pocketing the appeal she'd sent to him, he went out into the dusk to look for death. 3. The truck he threw himself in front of was unkind. It knocked the breath from him, but not the life. Bruised and bleeding from scrapes and cuts, he was scooped up and taken to the hospital. Later, he'd come to understand how all of this was in the scheme of things, and that he'd been denied his death beneath the truck wheels for a purpose. But sitting in the hospital, waiting in a white room till people worse off than he had been attended to, all he could do was curse his bad fortune. Other lives he could take with terrible ease. His own resisted him. Even in this, he was divided against himself. But that room, though he didn't know it when he was ushered in, held a promise its plain walls belied. In it he'd hear a name that would with time make a new man of him. At its call he'd go like the monster he was, by night, and meet with the miraculous. That name was Midian. It and he had much in common, not least that they shared the power to make promises. But while his avowals of eternal love had proved hollow in a matter of weeks, Midian made promises, midnight like his own, deepest midnight, that even death could not break. Chapter 3. The Rhapsodist. In the years of his illness, in and out of mental wards and hospices, Boone had met very few fellow sufferers who didn't cleave to some talisman, some object or keepsake, to stand guard at the gates of their heads and hearts. He'd learned quickly not to despise such charms. Whatever gets you through the night was an axiom he understood from hard experience. Most of these safeguards against chaos were personal to those who wielded them. Trinkets, keys, books, and photographs, mementos of good times treasured as defense against bad. But some belonged to the collective mind. They were words he would hear more than once, nonsense rhymes whose rhythms kept the pain at bay, names of gods. Among them, Midian. He'd heard the name of that place spoken maybe half a dozen times by people he'd met on the way through, usually those whose strength was all burned up. When they called on Midian, it was as a place of refuge, a place to be carried away to. And more, a place where whatever sins they'd committed, real or imagined, would be forgiven them. Boone didn't know the origins of this mythology, nor had he ever been interested enough to inquire. He had not been in need of forgiveness, or so he thought. Now he knew better. He had plenty to seek cleansing of, obscenities his mind had kept from him until Decker had brought them to light, which no agency he knew could lift from him. He had joined another class of creature. Midian called. Locked up in his misery, he'd not been aware that someone else now shared the white room with him, until he heard the rasping voice. Midian. He thought at first it was another voice from the past, like Lori's. But when it came again, it was not at his shoulder, as hers had been, but from across the room. He opened his eyes, the left lid gummy with blood from a cut on his temple, and looked toward the speaker. Another of the knights walking wounded, apparently, brought in for mending and left to fend for himself until some patchwork could be done. He was sitting in the corner of the room farthest from the door, on which his wild eyes were fixed as though at any moment his savior would step into view. It was virtually impossible to guess anything of his age or true appearance. Dirt and caked blood concealed both. I must look as bad or worse, Boone thought. He didn't much mind. People were always staring at him. In their present state, he and the man in the corner were the kind folks crossed the street to avoid. But whereas he, in his jeans and his scuffed boots and black T-shirt, was just another nobody, there were some signs about the other man that marked him out. The long coat he wore had a monkish severity to it. His gray hair pulled back tight on his scalp hung to the middle of his back in a plaited ponytail. There was jewelry at his neck, almost hidden by his high collar, and on his thumbs two artificial nails that looked to be silver, curled into hooks. Finally, there was that name, rising from the man again. "Will you take me?" he asked softly. "Take me to Midian?" His eyes had not left the door for an instant. It seemed he was oblivious to Boone, until without warning he turned his wounded head and spat across the room. The blood-marbled phlegm hit the floor at Boone's feet. "Get the fuck out of here," he said. "You're keeping them from me. They won't come while you're here." Boone was too weary to argue and too bruised to get up. He let the man rant. "Get out," he said again. "They won't show themselves the likes of you. Don't you see that?" Boone put his head back and tried to keep the man's pain from invading him. "Shit," the other said. "I've missed them. I've missed them." He stood up and crossed to the window. Outside, there was solid darkness.
"They passed by,"
he murmured, suddenly plaintive. The next moment, he was a yard from Boone, grinning through the air.
"Got anything for the pain?" he wanted to know.
"The nurse gave me something," Boone replied. The man spat again, not at Boone this time, but at the floor.
"Drink, man," he said. "Have you got a drink?"
"No." The grin evaporated instantly, and the face began to crumple up as tears overtook him. He turned away from Boone, sobbing, his litany begun again.
"Why won't they take me? Why won't they come for me?"
"Maybe they'll come later," Boone said, "when I've gone." The man looked back at him.
"What do you know?" he said.
Very little was the answer, but Boone kept that fact to himself. There were enough fragments of Midian's mythology in his head to have him eager for more. Wasn't it a place where those who had run out of refuges could find a home? And wasn't that his condition now? He had no source of comfort left, not Decker, not Lori, not even death. Even though Midian was just another talisman, he wanted to hear its story recited. "Tell me," he said.
"I asked what you know,"
the other man replied, catching the flesh beneath his unshaven chin with the hook of his left hand. "I know it takes away the pain," Boone replied.
"And?"
"I know it turns nobody away."
"Not true,"
came the response. "No?"
"If it turned nobody away, you think I wouldn't be there already? You think it wouldn't be the biggest city on earth? Of course it turns people away."
The man's tear-brightened eyes were fixed on Boone. "Does he realize I know nothing?" Boone wondered. It seemed not. The man talked on, content to debate the secret, or more particularly, his fear of it.
"I don't go because I may not be worthy," he said. "And they don't forgive that easily. They don't forgive at all. You know what they do to those who aren't worthy?"
Boone was less interested in Midian's rites of passage than in the man's certainty that it existed at all. He didn't speak of Midian as a lunatic's Shangri-La, but as a place to be found and entered and made peace with. "Do you know how to get there?" he asked. The man looked away. As he broke eye contact, a surge of panic rose in Boone. The bastard was going to keep the rest of the story to himself. "I need to know," Boone said. The other man looked up again.
"I can see that," he said,
and there was a twist in his voice that suggested the spectacle of Boone's despair entertained him.
"It's northwest of Athabasca,"
the man replied. "Yes?"
"That's what I heard."
"That's empty country," Boone said. "You could wander forever unless you've got a map."
"Midian's and no map," the man said. "You look east of Peace River, near Sheer Neck, north of Dwyer."
There was no taint of doubt in this recitation of directions. He believed in Midian's existence as much, perhaps more, than the four walls he was bound by. "What's your name?" Boone asked. The question seemed to flummox him. It had been a long time since anyone had cared to ask him his name.
"Narsis," he said finally. "You?"
"Aaron Boone. Nobody ever calls me Aaron, only Boone."
"Aaron," said the other, "where do you hear about Midian?"
"Same place you did," Boone said. "Same place anyone hears, from others, people in pain."
"Monsters," said Narsis.
Boone hadn't thought of them as such, but perhaps to dispassionate eyes they were, the ranters and the weepers, unable to keep their nightmares under lock and key.
"They're the only ones welcome in Midian," Narsis explained. "If you're not a beast, you're a victim. That's true, isn't it? You can only be one or the other. That's why I don't dare go unescorted. I wait for friends to come for me."
"People who went already?"
"That's right," Narsis said. "Some of them alive, some of them who died and went after."
Boone wasn't certain he was hearing this story correctly. "Went after?" he said.
"Don't you have anything for the pain, man?"
Narsis said, his tone veering again, this time to the wheedling. "I've got some pills," Boone said, remembering Decker's supply. "Do you want those?"
"Anything you got."
Boone was content to be relieved of them.
They'd kept his head in chains, driving him to the point where he didn't care if he lived or died. Now he did. He had a place to go, where he might find someone at last who understood the horrors he was enduring. He would not need the pills to get to Midian. He'd need strength, and the will to be forgiven. The latter he had. The former, his wounded body would have to find.
"Where are they?"
said Narciss, appetite igniting his features. Boone's leather jacket had been peeled from his back when he'd first been admitted for a cursory examination of the damage he'd done himself. It hung on the back of a chair, a twice-discarded skin. He plunged his hand into the inside pocket, but found to his shock that the familiar bottle was not there. "Someone's been through my jacket." He rummaged through the rest of the pockets. All of them were empty. Lori's notes, his wallet, the pills, all gone. It took him seconds only to realize why they'd want evidence of who he was and the consequence of that. He'd attempted suicide. No doubt they thought him prepared to do the same again. In his wallet was Decker's address. The doctor was probably already on his way to collect his erring patient and deliver him to the police. Once in the hands of the law, he'd never see Midian.
"You said there were pills!" Narciss yelled.
"They've been taken!" Narciss snatched the jacket from Boone's hands and began to tear at it.
"Where?" he yelled. "Where?"
His face was once more crumpling up as he realized he was not going to get a fix of peace. He dropped the jacket and backed away from Boone, his tears beginning again, but sliding down his face to meet a broad smile.
"I know what you're doing,"
he said, pointing at Boone. Laughter and sobs were coming in equal measure.
"Midian sent you to see if I'm worthy. You came to see if I was one of you or not."
He offered Boone no chance to contradict, his elation spiraling into hysteria.
"I'm sitting here praying for someone to come, begging, and you're here all the time, watching me shit myself, watching me shit."
He laughed hard. Then, deadly serious, he said,
"I never doubted. Never once. I always knew somebody'd come. But I was expecting a face I recognized. Marvin, maybe. I should have known they'd send someone new. Stands to reason. And you saw, right? You heard. I'm not ashamed. They never made me ashamed. You ask anyone. They tried. Over and over. They got in my fucking head and tried to take me apart. Tried to take the wild ones out of me. But I held on. I knew you'd come sooner or later, and I wanted to be ready. That's why I wear these."
He thrust his thumbs up in front of his face.
"So I could show you."
He turned his head right and left.
"Want to see?"
he said. He needed no reply. His hands were already up to either side of his face, the hooks touching the skin at the base of each ear. Boone watched, words of denial or appeal redundant. This was a moment Narciss had rehearsed countless times. He was not about to be denied it. There was no sound as the hooks, razor sharp, slit his skin, but blood began to flow instantly down his neck and arms. The expression on his face didn't change. It merely intensified, a mask in which comic, muse, and tragic were united. Then, fingers spread to either side of his face, he steadily drew the razor hooks down the line of his jaw. He had a surgeon's precision. The wounds opened with perfect symmetry until the twin hooks met at his chin. Only then did he drop one hand to his side, blood dripping from hook and wrist, the other moving across his face to seek the flap of skin his work had opened.
"You want to see,"
he said again. Boone murmured,
"Don't."
It went unheard. With the sharp upward jerk, Narciss detached the mask of skin from the muscle beneath and began to tear, uncovering his true face. From behind him, Boone heard somebody scream. The door had been opened, and one of the nursing staff stood on the threshold. He saw from the corner of his eye, her face whiter than her uniform, her mouth open wide, and beyond her the corridor and freedom. but he couldn't bring himself to look away from Narciss, not while the blood filling the air between them kept the revelation from view. He wanted to see the man's secret face, the wild one beneath the skin that made him fit for Midian's ease. The red rain was dispersing. The air began to clear. He saw the face now, a little, but couldn't make sense of its complexity. Was that a beast's anatomy that knotted up and snarled in front of him, or human tissue agonized by self-mutilation? A moment more and he'd know. Then someone had hold of him, seizing his arms and dragging him toward the door. He glimpsed Narciss raising the weapons of his hands to keep his saviors at bay. Then the uniforms were upon him, and he was eclipsed. In the rush of the moment, Boone took his chance. He pushed the nurse from him, snatched up his leather jacket, and ran for the unguarded door. His bruised body was not prepared for violent action. He stumbled, nausea and darting pains in his bruised limbs vying for the honor of bringing him to his knees. But the sight of Narciss, surrounded and tethered, was enough to give him strength. He was away down the hall before anyone had a chance to come after him. As he headed for the door to the night, he heard Narciss's voice raised in protest, a howl of rage that was pitifully human. Chapter 4. Necropolis. 1. Though the distance from Calgary to Athabasca was little more than 300 miles, the journey took a traveler to the borders of another world. North of here, the highways were few, the inhabitants fewer still. The rich prairie lands of the province steadily gave way to forest, marshland, and wilderness. It also marked the limits of Boone's experience. A short stint as a truck driver in his early 20s had taken him as far as Bonnyville to the southeast, Barrhead to the southwest, and Athabasca itself. But the territory beyond was unknown to him, except as names on a map, or more correctly, as an absence of names. There were great stretches of land here that were dotted only with small farming settlements, one of which bore the name Narciss had used, Sheer Neck. The map that carried this information he found, along with enough change to buy himself a bottle of brandy, in 5 minutes of theft on the outskirts of Calgary. He rifled 3 vehicles left in an underground parking facility and was away, mapped and moneyed, before the source of the car alarms had been traced by security. The rain washed his face, his bloodied T-shirt he dumped, happy to have his beloved jacket next to his skin. Then he found himself a ride to Edmonton, and another that took him through Athabasca to High Prairie. It was easy. 2. Easy. To go in search of a place he'd only heard rumor of among lunatics? Perhaps not easy, but it was necessary, even inevitable. From the moment the truck he'd chosen to die beneath had cast him aside, this journey had been beckoning. Perhaps from long before that, only he'd never seen the invitation. The sense he had of its rightness might almost have made a fatalist of him. If Midian existed and was willing to embrace him, then he was traveling to a place where he would finally find some self-comprehension and peace. If not, if it existed only as a talisman for the frightened and the lost, then that too was right. And he would meet whatever extinction awaited him, searching for a nowhere. Better that than the pills. Better that than Decker's fruitless pursuit of rhymes and reasons. The doctor's quest to root out the monster in Boone had been bound to fail. That much was clear as the skies overhead. Boone the man and Boone the monster could not be divided. They were one. They traveled the same road in the same mind and body. And whatever lay at the end of that road, death or glory, would be the fate of both. 3. East of Peace River, Narciss had said, near the town of Sheer Neck, north of Dwyer. He had to sleep rough in High Prairie. The following morning he found a ride to Peace River. The driver was in her late 50s, proud of the region she'd known since childhood and happy to give him a quick geography lesson. He made no mention of Midian, but Dwyer and Sheer Neck she knew. the latter a town of 5,000 souls away to the east of Highway 67. He'd have saved himself a good 200 miles if he'd not traveled as far as High Prairie, he was told, but taken himself north earlier. No matter, she said. She knew a place in Peace River where the farmers stopped off to eat before heading back to their homesteads. He'd find a ride there to take him where he wanted to go. Got people there? She asked. He said he had. It was close to dusk by the time the last of his rides dropped him a mile or so shy of Dwyer. He watched the truck take a gravel road off into the deepening blue, then began to walk the short distance to the town. A night of sleeping rough and traveling in farm vehicles and roads that had seen better days had taken its toll on his already battered system. It took him an hour to come within sight of the outskirts of Dwyer, by which time night had fallen completely. Fate was once again on his side. Without the darkness, he might not have seen the lights flashing ahead, not in welcome, but in warning. The police were here before him, 3 or 4 cars, he judged. It was possible they were in pursuit of someone else entirely, but he doubted it. More likely Narcisse, lost to himself, had told the law what he'd told Boone, in which case this was a reception committee. They were probably already searching for him, house to house. And of here, in Sheerneck, too. He was expected. Thankful for the cover of the night, he made his way off the field and into the middle of a rapeseed field, where he could lie and think through his next move. There was certainly no wisdom in trying to go into Dwyer. Better he set off for Midian now, putting his hunger and weariness aside, and trusting to the stars and his instinct to give him directions. He got up and headed off in what he judged to be a northerly direction. He knew very well he might miss his destination by miles with such rough bearings to travel by, or just as easily fail to see it in the darkness. No matter. He had no other choice, which was a kind of comfort to him. In his 5-minute spree as thief, he'd not found a watch to steal, so the only sense he had of time passing was the slow progression of the constellations overhead. The air became cold, then bitter, but he kept up his painful pace, avoiding the roads wherever possible, though they would have been easier to walk than the plowed and seeded ground. This caution proved well-founded at one point, when 2 police vehicles, bookending a black limousine, slid all but silently down a road he had a minute ago crossed. He had no evidence whatsoever for the feeling that seized him as the cars passed by, but he sensed more than strongly that the limo's passenger was Decker, the good doctor, still in pursuit of understanding. 4. Then, Midian. Out of nowhere, Midian. One moment the night ahead was featureless darkness, the next there was a cluster of buildings on the horizon, their painted walls glimmering gray-blue in the starlight. Boone stood for several minutes and studied the scene. There was no light burning in any window or on any porch. By now it was surely well after midnight, and the men and women of the town, with work to rise to the following morning, would be in bed. But not one single light? That struck him as strange. Small Midian might be, forgotten by mapmakers and signpost writers alike. But did it not lay claim to one insomniac? Or a child who needed the comfort of a lamp burning through the night hours? More probably they were in wait for him, Decker and the law, concealed in the shadows until he was foolish enough to step into the trap. The simplest solution would be to turn tail and leave them to their vigil, but he had little enough energy left. If he retreated now, how long would he have to wait before attempting a return, every hour making recognition and arrest more likely? He decided to skirt the edge of the town and get some sense of the lay of the land. If he could find no evidence of a police presence, then he'd enter and take the consequences. He hadn't come all this way to turn back. Midian revealed nothing of itself as he moved around its southeastern flank, except perhaps its emptiness. Not only could he see no sign of police vehicles in the streets or secreted between the houses, he could see no automobile of any kind, no truck, no farm vehicle. He began to wonder if the town was one of those religious communities he'd read of, whose dogmas denied them electricity or the combustion engine. But as he climbed toward the spine of a small hill on the summit of which Midian stood, a second and plainer explanation occurred. There was nobody in Midian. The thought stopped him in his tracks. He stared across at the houses, searching for some evidence of decay, but he could see none. The roofs were intact as far as he could make out. There were no buildings that appeared on the verge of collapse. Yet, with a night so quiet he could hear the whoosh of falling stars overhead, he could hear nothing from the town. If somebody in Midian had moaned in his sleep, the night would have brought the sound his way. But there was only silence. Midian was a ghost town. Never in his life had he felt such desolation. He stood like a dog returned home to find its masters gone, not knowing what his life now meant or would ever mean again. It took him several minutes to uproot himself and continue his circuit of the town. 20 yards on from where he'd stood, however, the height of the hill gave him sight of a scene more mysterious even than the vacant Midian. On the far side of the town lay a cemetery. His vantage point gave him an uninterrupted view of it, despite the high walls that bounded the place. Presumably it had been built to serve the entire region, for it was massively larger than a town Midian size could ever have required. Many of the mausoleums were of impressive scale, that much was clear even from a distance. The layout of avenues, trees, and tombs lent the cemetery the appearance of a small city. Boone began down the slope of the hill toward it, his route taking him well clear of the town itself. After the adrenaline rush of finding and approaching Midian, he felt his reserves of strength failing fast. The pain and exhaustion that expectation had numbed now returned with a vengeance. It could not be long, he knew, before his muscles gave out completely and he collapsed. Perhaps behind the cemetery's walls, he'd be able to find a niche to conceal himself from his pursuers and rest his bones. There were two means of access, a small gate in the side wall and large double gates that faced toward the town. He chose the former. It was latched, but not locked. He gently pushed it open and stepped inside. The impression he'd had from the hill of the cemetery as city was here confirmed, the mausoleums rising house high around him. Their scale and, now that he could study them up close, their elaborate decor puzzled him. What great families had occupied the town or its surrounds, moneyed enough to bury their dead in such splendor? The small communities of the prairie clung to the land as their sustenance, but it seldom made them rich.